You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this hour is Diane Kahneman. I'm going to get this pronunciation. And it's good to have you here this morning, Diane.
Thank you.
So the way the show starts is we begin by asking, you know, who are you? What are some of the qualities or labels or experiences that would be a good starting point for us to know who you are so we can have this conversation where we get to know each other over the course of the hour?
Okay. Well, who I am, I can define myself by roles that I have. I'm a mother. I'm a widow twice. I am a daughter of a mother who's 93 years old, and that is another responsibility. I've had an incredible life, I think, despite some challenges. Mm-hmm. And I think I've lived through those challenges, and they make you stronger in the end.
Right.
What did I tell you that tells you about me? I've had the incredible opportunity to travel.
Mm-hmm.
I've been on every continent and every state in the United States, almost all the provinces in Canada. And when I say that, I feel like I'm bragging, and I don't, because I just feel that it was not all by myself I did this, but I had the fortunate opportunity to do those things, and all of that has helped shape me and who I am and where I am.
Right, right. And it's hard to share the wonder of our lives without also feeling like, are we really bragging?
Yes, yes.
And
that's been what worried me about coming here.
Life has turned out richer and different and probably more painful than you thought it would be my guess.
That would be really true. When I was a kid growing up on a farm in central Pennsylvania, I never imagined that I would get to travel as much as I have. I can tell you that I've sort of gone through even a evolution in my career. I have a bachelor's degree from Penn State. I didn't really want to go there, but it was as far as my parents were willing to
support you or go?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
All of the above.
Yeah, well, you know, it was 60 miles from home, and so and I had a degree in home economics, which when I was in school, you know, teaching and home economists and nurses were sort of the careers for women. And
right.
So it was, all right, this is where I'm going to end up. I really started in art but decided I wasn't good enough for that. And I came to Cooperative Extension in New York State and had a long career there, but not the same career. I started out as a home economist. I moved into another county where I picked up on more community development kind of work. Like mm-hmm. I wrote a column for the local newspaper on local government to help people understand that. I went into administration things. Then I was off to Binghamton, where I was director of their cooperative extension program, and at the same time got a master's degree in political science and management,
uh-huh.
which just seems like quite of a change. And then from there, I came to Cornell and became director of an agriculture leadership program. And it just sort of, it's like this little farm girl is now helping all these agriculture people do a better job of relating to people is what I saw it.
Mm-hmm.
And here I am in Ithaca yet because
right.
I started on that job.
Right, and you just tied with this last comment, doing a better job of relating to people. All of your first descriptions when you introduced yourself had to do with relationships.
Yeah.
And how important they, what I inferred was how important relationships and the qualities of relationships are mm-hmm. in your life.
Mm-hmm.
Let us take a few minutes and go to some music. What would you like to start with?
Why don't you start with the very first one, the one from Africa?
Okay. And do you want to introduce this singer or why you chose this music?
The singer I had no knowledge of till I was looking for African music to share.
That felt authentic.
Yes.
Yeah.
I wanted it to be authentic, not something that Americans have co-opted. And I can tell you a little more about it after you listen to it.
Okay. Well, here we go. This is a piece called The King's Son, and the singer is, where is his name? John Shabani from Tanzania.
wamfame,
wamfame.
Baba yangu mimi ni mfame,
mfame.
Ninahisi kama mfame,
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 mfame.
Sina hofu wala wasi wasi,
mfame.
Baba ananiwazia mema,
mfame.
Kila nitakacho ananipa,
mfame,
mfame,
mfame.
Mfalme,
mfalme,
jitambue leo wewe mtoto
wa mfalme.
Hebu ishi kama mfalme,
mfalme.
Baba yetu yeye ni mfalme,
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 mfalme.
Mimi ni mtoto wa mfalme,
wa mfalme.
Hallelujah. Mimi ni mtoto wa mfalme. Hata kama sina kitu leo, lakini mimi ni mtoto wa mfalme. Nimeumbwa kama mfalme, kwa mfano wa Mungu. Nitaishi, nitayasimulia mema ya Mungu. Hallelujah.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this hour is Diane Kahneman. Diane, the stories that you tell and the changes that you don't really, you haven't told stories yet so much as you have listed experiences. What made it possible for you to be the kind of person that could be open to that kind of experience? What happened to you in life, or how did you get started, or what changed that made it possible for you to be open? I mean, it seems like you started out with art as a focus, but you quickly moved on to something else. What made you that way, or how did you become aware of yourself?
I think it's been very incremental. Mm-hmm. One of the first stories I'd share is that between my junior and senior year at Penn State, my major within home economics was housing, which was a very new emphasis. And that summer we were to do an internship, and I ended up with public housing in Philadelphia. First of all, I'd never really been to a big city.
Right.
But people had guided me to this kind Italian lady in an Italian neighborhood where I could stay, and I went in, I'm curious enough to find my way.
Sure.
Went in to meet the person who was to be my boss in this adventure, and I just never had thought about it, but the man was black, and I was like, oh, well, that's okay. But it was my first experience of really interacting with somebody who was a non-white, very different.
Uh-huh.
And so then I worked in several public housing settings of helping people learn to sew, you know, traditional home economics things,
sure,
and
yeah,
so forth.
Yeah.
And one day, one of the policemen from Philadelphia, who would stop in to see one of the women at one of these authorities, gave me a ride down to the elevated, and he said to me, "Now, is she black?" And I said, "I don't know." But he was a person of color, and
right,
I wouldn't know. You know, it doesn't matter if you're black or not, I don't think. But it was very curious to me that somebody who was different from me was also questioning, well, who is that person?
Right.
And so that was kind of my start on realizing this world is much bigger and broader than I ever thought. I also went to a community fair one night because I was directed there, and I walked probably 10 blocks from the elevated to where the site was in a school, and one of the women in charge there said, "How'd you get here?" And I said, "I walked from the elevated." And she said, "You shouldn't be walking in this neighborhood." And she gave me a ride back at the end of the evening, which was a little darker. And I wasn't afraid. I think it was partly, even though at that time I don't really realize it, but I think it was partly my faith that what is to be is to be, and God is here with me, and I will do what has to be done. I did grow up in a family that regularly went to church, and I wouldn't say that we were very open with our faith. You know, again, it's that
right,
sort of, we don't talk about this at other places. But we did know that it was important to think about your faith.
Okay, and just because you brought the word up, I want to, what was that faith that you kind of kept protected in that space that you're not, protected is my word, not yours. What was that faith that you didn't really opt to talk about in a big way, but what was the quality, what were the qualities that that faith had?
Well, and I don't know as I could verbalize it then as I would now,
sure,
but from my perspective, Christ died and gave us the grace of forgiveness of all our sins, and you know, all of us are sinners, and also then that our response to that should be sharing and helping other people. And we always did things for other people when I was growing up. I can remember my mother giving somebody a ride to go to the doctor, and she left her wallet in the car. After we dropped her off, we realized, and I can remember opening that wallet that had, I think, a quarter in it and a Social Security card. That was all that person had. And that, you know, it's like, wow, how lucky I am. And, you know, we returned it, and she was so grateful. It was amazing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my mother said, "You can take it up to her apartment." So, I really truly believe that we don't earn our way into heaven, and I don't even worry about what the afterlife is, but we have forgiveness, and therefore you try your best, and if you screw it up, well, we all know I tried.
and we all screw it up.
Yeah.
And both by what we do and what we leave undone.
I think the
catechism.
Yeah. So can I take it back,
sure,
to why
yeah,
I
yeah,
chose that song we played?
Yeah.
So that song is a takeoff for me in that right after I retired from Cornell, and I retired fairly early in year 2000, I had the opportunity to travel with Lutheran World Relief to Africa, and we were going to learn about fair trade coffee. But we also went to church services that were incredible in terms of the relationships among people, their sharing. Often offering was bringing up something that you could that you could share. Sugar cane, maybe a gallon of milk if you had a cow, just other things like that.
Right.
And they were all up front. These gifts were freely given.
All on the table, all on the altar, or however you called it.
It was
front.
Too much for the altar. It was always stacked. Yeah. And then after church, they kind of auctioned those things off to people who had a need for them, and they were converted to cash or some other way. But the music was always with great, you know, it was tunes I knew.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And but but shared in a way that they really cared about their faith. And so that was a huge impression on me, too. That, in turn, led me to the Foods Resource Bank, which is here in the United States, and and helps farmers with projects to raise money to for sustainable agriculture projects in other parts of the world. I had seen some of that in practice when I was in Tanzania, and so, and since then, some of the people that have been local leaders of these projects have come to the United States to visit farmers here and so forth. And one of the things that I heard somebody say when she was talking about her experience here was, she said, "I feel so sorry for you because you have all this stuff to take care of." And that has always stuck with me, as she is so right. I have had to dispose of things that, when they died, of a garage full of stuff that was packed so full. It's so ridiculous of how much value we put on stuff. And my husband George used to say, "Yeah, it's an Americans who have the garage to put stuff in and their cars parked in the driveway." But it's stuff even beyond that we we accumulate.
Right. So I want to go back to that service in Tanzania or in Africa. And you had said there was something that was so genuine or so engaged or alive about their expression of faith that it changed you. What did it touch that freed you to take on different work when you came back? What was it that made more genuine in you by being close to it?
I just think it was because you could see that they cared for each other, and how they shared with us when they had so little by comparison.
Right.
And it's like, I how can I be selfish and not help other people, because here are people who have much less than I do and are much, much more generous.
Right, and that links tightly with the statement, I feel sorry for you because you have so much stuff. When we have stuff, our energy goes to care for the stuff and not so much for each other. In fact, we may not even see each other. I have stuff, not as much as I once felt the burden of carrying my history around with me, but it's still too much stuff, and its weight feels oppressive.
It can.
I think, and no, it can. You're right. It doesn't always feel that way, but sometimes it does. So you described yourself as curious.
Oh, yeah.
How did you develop that curiosity, and where did it come from? Was it something that came when you went to college, or was it something that was there from early on?
Well, I think part of it was that my mother was always a reader, and she encouraged us to read, so you would read to learn about things. Later on, I can remember, just because of political things, wanting to go to Russia. And my first husband said, gave me a book called Journey to Russia, and he said, "Here's your trip to Russia."
Yes.
Which he had no ever intention of doing that, but I read it, and it was like, I still want to go to Russia. And one of the first major trips I took was after he died, and my mother wanted to go to Russia. So I think that you pick up some of that curiosity from other people, and we went. It was in 94. It was not, well, it was,
it was after the fall, after the liberalization.
Yeah, it was. It was. And so there was more openness at that time. But it wasn't easy. There's a lot of people in Russia who are very afraid of things. I think in Russia that power is such an important thing that when you get a little bit, you really exercise it. I can remember being in one of the mansions and leaning over to look at something, and the woman was cracking my knuckles with a newspaper, and I was not touching. I may have been pointing, but you know, I was definitely out of bounds, and you know, we were told not to touch. I was not going to touch, but it was like she was
in
charge.
She didn't trust you.
Yeah. And so, and at the end, our tickets home were not right. Were not synced with a. We were on one of the river cruises, which limits a little bit of your experience because you. It was Swiss run, and you got more German food than Russian food, but and when we were leaving the boat, the guy in the boat said, you know, your tickets aren't till tomorrow and you can't stay here tonight. And we went to the airport. We had two of the Russian guides, and they were very fearful. And but I went with one of them up to the airlines, which I think at that time was Finnair. Mm-hmm. And they were trying to explain and weren't. And finally, I just said, do you speak English? And the clerk said, oh, yes. And we got it straightened out. So we flew to Finland, stayed in a Holiday Inn that night, and we were fine. But my reflection was, if I can travel in Russia and get home safely, I can do almost anything.
Uh-huh.
So it's those kind of challenges that sort of build you up to try other things.
Curiosity leads to risk.
Yes.
Which leads to challenges, which leads to resilience or failure, or sometimes both.
Exactly. What a nice summary.
No, but it's your path and mine are not all that dissimilar. I had the funny situation of winning the Betty Crocker Family Leader of Tomorrow Award in my high school when I was a senior, because it was home economics based,
and
it was largely based on how to manage a household. In terms of the whole spectrum of issues and stuff. So, and I came, you know, I've always looked at these issues holistically in terms of how we live in families and communities. That's very much where I am. And with curiosity, you describe reading books and how they can open your world up. We had three sets of encyclopedias in the house with the seven children and my parents. And most of us read all of them at some point or another. It allowed us to practice experiencing difference at a safe distance.
That's true.
And I hear your story about showing up in the housing projects to work for an African American man who you didn't anticipate, but you were nonplussed by it.
Yes.
It was notable, but it didn't shut you down.
Yeah.
That kind of openness is really critical, and we've kind of taken to mocking it a little bit because it's not aware sometimes of the implicit racism, the ignorance based racism, which is very much there. But you can work with that if you stay on everybody's questioning, like the African American man who was asking you about the identity of the other person. If you stay on that side of curiosity, you can kind of figure things out without damaging each other and getting into excessive conflict, even though you may read things differently.
So the man I worked for had asked me the question, why are you doing this? And I said, because I've always learned that we're supposed to leave the world a little better place than what we found it. You know, that doesn't mean you can change the whole world, but it does mean that, hey, I need to do my share to make something a little bit better.
Right.
And I thought that was a time that made me stop and think about, all right, who am I and what would I?
And you were late teens, early 20s?
Yes.
And you framed your faith?
Yes. Yes.
Which is what you described you grew up with. And a lot of us, you know, having people who will draw those markers out of us or pushing ourselves to kind of rediscover them, either way works.
I would say my faith is the theology that gets pushed on us about very specific things I don't care a lot about. But I do like to I've been reading Bonhoeffer recently, and I think I'm a Bonhoeffer type of person because of his knowledge that we need to live in the world.
Right, and live fully in the world, unapologetically.
Yeah. Yes.
He could, without mocking God or himself, participate in the plot against Hitler's life and not expect God to forgive him, but he could know that he could not do otherwise.
Yes. Yes.
And that kind of moral subtlety is something that you don't learn intellectually, you learn it by experience, by loving people who don't know how to deal with each other.
It's true.
And loving people you don't know how to deal with until you figure something out.
Yeah.
That's, you know, so it also harkens back to the notion of faith, which we had a definition 200 years ago, which was it only meant an experience or a quality of hope and trust. It didn't mean an outcome, and it didn't mean a proposition, an intellectual proposition. And at the same time, belief didn't mean an intellectual proposition or a theological statement. Belief meant what you loved.
Yep.
Belief and beloved are the same root in English. You've lived it implicitly in rural central Pennsylvania. Where in rural central Pennsylvania?
A small town called Mifflinburg. If you go down Route 15, it's just west of Lewisburg.
Yep. I've been very near there. I did some work in Lewisburg and some in Williamsport, not too far away.
Yes.
Yeah. Cool. What song would you like to go to next?
I can do either one, the servant song.
Sure. And shall we take it up afterwards?
Okay.
I think.
Will you let me be your servant? Let me be as Christ to you. Let you be my servant too.
We are pilgrims on a journey. We are travelers on the road. We are here to help each other.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, 88.1 in Ithaca and 91.9 in Watkins Glen. And this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this hour is Diane Kahneman. So Diane, the servant song, that has become a very, very powerful and popular song in Christian churches around the country.
So I first became acquainted with it actually very recently. Mm-hmm. I read the book When Breath Becomes Air, which is about a brain surgeon. I can't think of the technical word.
A neurosurgeon.
Thank you.
Yeah.
It's like remembering names sometimes. They evade me. And he talks about his life. He wrote his story as he was dying from cancer. As he finished up his residency, he found he had stage 4 lung cancer. And that's the end of the story, but he goes back and talks about how he thought he'd be a writer, but he found his way into neurosurgery. And he talks about how he related with patients, which I thought was just wonderful in terms of explaining things in terms that people could understand. So the song is mentioned in there because he and his wife had a very deepening relationship as he was sick. Mm-hmm. And it was this whole thing of, I will share your joy and sorrow till we've seen this journey through, that really tugs at my heartstrings in terms of there's ups and downs and we do it together. Mm-hmm. And so it's, I picked it for that reason. And then the other thing, pray that I may have the grace to let you be my servant too.
Yeah.
I tend to be, I'm much more open to people helping me than I did early on. Mm-hmm. In fact, my husband George was sick for a long time. He had congestive heart failure. And I wanted to be able to have him at home until this journey was over, and it just became impossible. And the next song comes from that too. Mm-hmm. But I couldn't believe the number of people who offered to do things for me and that I accepted.
Right.
And it just made a difference. I can remember saying to somebody that I just couldn't believe all the people who are so helpful. And they said, oh, that was because you're helpful. I said, but that shouldn't be be a good reason. Right. It's because they just care about people too.
Right. And yes. And each of our well-being is intimately bound up with the other.
Yeah.
I have had a hard time learning to be gentle sometimes in expressing things that are important. But there was a time in my life as a pastor where I would strongly discourage to the point of not allowing people to take leadership roles serving others if they hadn't received the service of others. Mm-hmm. Because the knowledge gained from being a recipient of others' care and being aware of it and asking for it and negotiating it and the gratitude that comes from it is just so enormously important. Mm-hmm. And to find a way to dance on both sides, because we are on both sides.
Yeah. I can relate to that. My high school yearbook said I was frank. And recently I've developed a friendship where the person said to me, I really like you because you call a spade a spade. And, sometimes you wonder, is that a compliment or not?
Yeah. Well, let's say, I know I've had those comments.
I figured you could relate to that.
Yeah. So how has being a servant and being served forced you to grow in ways that you might not have chosen or might not have anticipated?
Well, I think it's much more gratitude for the life I have, because sometimes you maybe want to feel sorry for yourself, and then you stop and say, how can I feel sorry for myself when I have all these people that have helped me and that I have been willing to accept that help, and I in turn now can help even more people. So I think it just deepened the commitments that I had before.
Right. And when you start out life with abundant curiosity and wonder, it's hard to be grateful because life is just one constant running show.
Yeah.
And until you get knocked back, mm-hmm. one doesn't know what one's grateful for. So, yeah. And that's the other side of resilience.
Yep.
Or part of that other thing. And I can see you having learned it later because of the trajectory of your life.
Yep.
How have you tried to share this experience of faith in your family or with your friends, or have you?
I try. I don't think I've been as successful at that as I would like to be sometimes. But
what would success be? I mean, I don't even know the answer.
I don't know the answer to that either. But I don't think that I've really shared why I do what I do sometimes as much as I should. I have a brother who's very intent on managing his finances and so forth. Mm-hmm. And he, you know, he says, I can do that. I don't want to pay somebody else to do it. And I really should say to him, Mark, look, money's not everything. And yes, I have some resources. When you lose two husbands, you accumulate resources. But I have somebody manage that. I don't want to spend my time on that. There's mm-hmm. more important things in life. And I think I need to be more upfront about what I think is important. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. I don't always do that, I don't think.
Right. And it's also, though, it's an important thing. You don't have to manage it, but you need to know that it's well managed.
Exactly.
So that you can also do the things that you are skillful at or are called to do.
Right. And there's people that are much more skillful at managing money than I am.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and that's a
and I don't envy them the fee at all.
Right, right. But what you're talking about is living life, and to use the religious terms, in a covenant relationship where we do for others what they cannot do for themselves, and we ask for ourselves what we cannot do so well for ourselves, but we need from others.
Yeah.
And sometimes we need to learn to do stuff for ourselves that we lean on others for that we could do for ourselves, and sometimes others need to learn that too. But it's a process of negotiating and living the life we choose.
And there's another piece to it.
Sure.
Way back when I was a cooperative extension agent, I rode to a meeting with an agriculture agent who he was driving, we were going through farmland and mm-hmm. stuff, and he said to me, you know, I don't think I own my farm. I'm only the caretaker of it because it's God's world and God's land. And, that's one of those things that's really stuck with me. Yeah, I have this money, but it's really not my money. Right. It's money that can be used that would be carry out the will of God.
Right, and with another hat that I wear, the value of money really represents the reliability of the relationships that stand behind it,
mm-hmm.
which in
mm-hmm.
a sense is the quality of God's will as we experience it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not the same every place, and it's not as developed every place, and some places it's privileged more than others.
That's true.
And but you hold it not because of its intrinsic worth, but that it's a symbol of what we can or should or could do with each other. Mm-hmm. And it's Sunday morning and I'm turning into a preacher here. So, but you're giving me some entry points.
Sorry about that.
No. It's good. What did your husband's health decline and your ability to respond to that or not be able to as much as you might have, what did that teach you? We're doing this in a lead into the song In God Alone.
I think it taught me that we're here to care for each other, and even though it's hard and painful, you get a certain amount of gratefulness that you have the privilege of caring for somebody who had such an impact on life and who was, even to the end, could draw himself up to meet with guests and carry on conversations and continue to tell stories. Sometimes they got a little mixed up, but and I can remember once he said to somebody, well, I think I'm gonna be able to get better. And afterward, I said to him, why did you say that? He said, I said that because I want them to feel better about this whole thing. And I realized, yes, that's okay. Mm-hmm. You know, I thought it wasn't facing up to the truth. And so when you care for other people, you just learn things that they tell you that you hadn't thought about.
Right. And it's funny when people come to that realization that others are caring for them, but they... in their dying need to care for others. And you can say that, like he said it, or you can say, I'm going to be all right.
Yeah.
I'm going to be all right.
Yep.
And those are words of comfort, and there's no perfect way to say them, and you have to read the person who's come to you and offer them what they need that you can
yes.
offer them.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Wow.
Yep.
Wow.
And he had a dear friend that he would always, be optimistic with, and after he died, that person said to me, I was so hopeful that he would be better for a lot. And I thought, yeah, George mm-hmm. gave him that hope.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And by having the hope, they continued to relate to each other with openness. Whereas had they had despair or fear, they would have been, they wouldn't have had the kindness to each other.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, yep. you use two words almost interchangeably. One was optimism and the other one was hope. And what optimism is oftentimes, I think, better thought of as a bet on how it's going to work out. Mm-hmm. And we can be optimistic or pessimistic, but it's our calculation. But hope is a stance.
Yep.
And I have, one of my friends has this tagline on his email, a prisoner of defiant hope. and it's just because with the hope you can face anyone and anything and do more mm-hmm. than if you are shut down.
Yep. Yep.
And
yep, yep.
your husband seemed to have learned that lesson mightily.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. He and he gave that to his students. He was an incredible teacher because
what did he teach?
Agriculture. Economics was sort of the title, but mm-hmm. it was farm management and rural real estate appraisal. But he advised hundreds of students. He was also an associate dean for instruction at Cornell. Mm-hmm, so, mm-hmm.
And a colleague of Dan Sisler, who was one of my favorite professors at Cornell.
Yes, he was.
I took ag
and
intro.
He had a sense of humor, of an ability to tell stories, and one of his students spoke at his funeral and just told about how George knew his father and said to him, "How's your father doing?" It wasn't a personal thing, but he knew about him.
Yeah.
And the student who felt he wasn't maybe all that worthy was just incredulous that somebody knew something about his life.
And not only knew it, but had the grace to ask.
Yes, yes.
Well, let's play In God Alone.
Okay.
And do you want to comment on that first, or just let it speak for itself? Or speak afterwards?
Go ahead.
Sure.
When I saw a new earth, a new heaven,
no more thirst, no more love.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. This is the Made of Clay Report, and our desk guest on this hour is Diane Kahneman. So, Diane, there was one little piece that we were going to talk about that we didn't get to, and you're raising an angle that, when we were playing the music, that you have an appreciation for farming at a variety of different scales.
That's true.
So what does that mean here in a place like Ithaca?
I have an incredible respect for people who are doing CSAs and the small farms and the quality of organic produce and so forth. But I also worry very much about, in America, how limiting that is in terms of income and people that are living on the edge in terms of income and what they have to work with. And I see too many who start and only make it for 3 or 4 years and then they can't keep that up.
They can't keep it up, and they may even have a lot of debt when they get out of it.
Exactly. Yeah. And there's a lot of scorn here for people who have large farms. And I would agree that there's large farms that are way over the top. But one of the larger farms that's fairly close to Ithaca is up in Lansing, mm-hmm. and it's the Walnut Acres Farm, which used to be Hardy Farms. It's now four partners, but they're partners because of their value on families, and so that they can have more flexibility, take time off to go to their
kids. So there are four families that are doing it.
Right, yeah. Right, and they are incorporated, but they, because of that, they spend time with their kids. They go to soccer games. They do all these kinds of things. They take vacations. Mm-hmm. And I see that as incredibly valuable and that people need to appreciate that. And the production of milk is high quality, and it's much more efficient.
Right.
Some of the CSAs around here have formed some cooperatives where I focus on this part of it, you do that part, and we offer a full plate to
right.
all of our customers. But It takes some of that kind of creative organization, I think, to make it work better.
Right, right, and there are trade-offs, and there are efficiencies that can be achieved on very small scale that are very useful, especially with high value small items.
Right.
And then with more standardized items, the efficiencies are usually larger scale.
Yep.
And we need to have a more subtle way of thinking. There's a tendency to confuse in science and in religion a way that works for somebody and doesn't work for somebody else as the right way versus the wrong way.
Right.
And that is generally not helpful thinking.
That's right. That's right. There's and in terms of faith, I am really suspicious of those who think I have the answer, because I don't think there is always the answer. And I don't think God is only there for certain Christians or even certain faiths.
Right, right, right. And I want to play with a mathematical model. If you've got more than three variables, there's no optimal solution. And almost anything that matters has more than three variables.
Yeah, that's true.
And so we need to get over it and start trying to figure out how we can step back and let people take their approaches and learn from their mistakes, but also help them, even if we don't necessarily believe in them, and ask for them to help, even if they don't agree with us.
Right.
Because that true. Kind of working together helps us learn lessons that we wouldn't otherwise learn, because we're kind of stuck in our own minds.
When I was organizing committees and so forth, and somebody'd say to me, well, we don't want that person, they don't agree. And I said, that's the person we need to have. And the way I used to put it is, you need to have your enemies close at hand. And they weren't necessarily enemies, but people who you really, if you didn't have a conversation, you didn't learn from what they were, their perspective.
Right. And we oftentimes have the most to learn from those who are least like us.
That's true.
That's another way of saying it. I like it's like the 3-year-old at the children's sermon. You want to have that very active 3-year-old right with your arm around him or her, so that you can manage it without being excessively controlling.
And
but it's also just letting people be.
And I think that's why I've learned a lot from my travels, because there's a lot of people that I've met who are very different from me, and it gives you something to think about.
And keeping your enemies close at hand is also a way of loving them. if it's not condescending.
Yes, yes.
Where they are your equal.
Yes, yes.
In terms of importance and heft, and right. that you may not agree, but that's fine.
Yeah.
So tell me, this is the portion of the show where I like to ask, you know, what do you do on a daily, weekly, monthly, regular basis to kind of restore yourself emotionally, intellectually, physically? I think those three add up to spiritually myself, but that's my particular bias.
I exercise regularly. I go to three classes a week because I need the sense of community and exercising. I find that to just do it on my own at home is
you get
not,
bored.
Yeah, right. And I walk with some friends. I try to do daily exercises, or not exercises, devotions. I do that for a while, and then sometimes I'll slip away. But I find when I start my day with getting up and sitting and spending some time contemplating what thankfulness and what's help for the coming day, that my day goes much better.
Right. And what are your devotions like? Do you use materials? Do you just go back to the thankfulness or the gratitude questions yourself? Or
it varies. Mm-hmm. I've just finished a 40 days journey with Bonhoeffer, which is selected writings and scripture and mm-hmm. so forth. Mm-hmm. And I'll use some of those. And then some days it's just, oh God, help me today.
Yeah. And how do you know, in the middle of the day or in the middle of time, how do you know you need to kind of check in with yourself, or you need to kind of right the ship, or are you pretty much just a person who has a steady schedule and you kind of stick to it?
I really tend to be somebody who's got lots of projects and lots of things to do. Mm-hmm. And there are days when I'm really exhausted at the end of the day, and I say to myself, no, it's time to quit. You don't need to do whatever this evening. It's time to take something where you have off time.
Right. My guess is you're doing that more in later life than you would have done it in earlier life.
That's true.
Yeah. For lots of reasons.
Yeah.
So when things begin to get awkward for you or difficult, what happens? How do you know your focus is not? I mean, you say at the end of the day you're tired, but how do you know that you need to do kind of an attitude or spirit adjustment?
I don't know if I can explain that very well. I just get to a point where I just say, wait a minute, Diane, this is crazy. And part of it is I know that I have to say no. I tend to agree to do things, and then I say, but I've got this and this and this.
So you see the weight of things pile on, and at some point you begin to cower. I've got to say no.
Yeah.
You're not alone.
I know that.
Yeah.
But and I can remember once saying to my doctor, I don't know how I handle all this, and he said to me, well, you stand in front of the mirror and you say, practice saying no. And so I remember that, and I say, yeah, I need to practice no here. So,
right
now we're in the process of selling my mother's home, and so I've been back and forth to Pennsylvania lots of times, and I realize, you know, that's something that has to be done, and I have to say no to some other things.
Right. And maybe this is a obfuscation, or maybe this isn't quite honest on my part, but if I can say yes in a way that doesn't compromise myself, then mm-hmm. I can feel better than just saying outright no.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause there are people oftentimes hearing just, I can do this piece, but I can't do anything else. That has felt at times like that would be more respectful, both of my limits and of their need to be acknowledged.
Okay. So, recently negotiated a deadline. Somebody asked me to work on some written materials, and I said, I can't do it in May. If I do it by mid-June, is that okay?
Yeah.
And then they said, sure.
Sure, yeah. And one of the things is, if we are people pleasers, we want to do it just as it's been asked.
Yeah.
And then we confuse the respect of others and not respecting our own.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's true.
Diane, it has been wonderful to get to know you a little bit here.
Okay.
We're going to close with Amazing Grace. And is there anything else you want to note before we call it a day?
No, I just would say that thank you for the opportunity to explore who I am, because it makes me do it. I think I probably get as much out of spending this time as anybody else. So thank you.
Well, I appreciate that. And I also just really enjoy getting to know you and getting to know people.
Thank you.
And if you want to, if you missed part of the show and would like to listen to it, it's available. It will be available at madeofclay.org, along with 300 other shows from the past 3 years.
I will probably listen to it eventually. When I used to do radio or television, I'd say, well, the only person out there who really cares is my mother. And so so it'll take me a while.
Well, now you have daughters, too, or you have children,
I
too.
Do.
So
they
may care. And grandchildren? No.
Yes, that's true. That's true.
So, no, and that has been one place where people, even one of the couples that I interviewed a couple of years ago or a year and a half ago, they got together to listen to their show on their anniversary this year.
Mm.
And that was their way of marking time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Thank you, Diane.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that